How do we scale up urban agriculture to get healthy food to people in cities, but also to provide jobs and create healthy, sustainable communities for the benefit of all? Will Allen, a beloved figure who has had a powerful influence on urban agriculture, has lots to say about quite a few things, such as the general state of agriculture, the effect of large-scale farming on the little guy, the depressed pricing of the dairy industry, and the list goes on. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Farming. Past, present, and future. Our guest today really does know quite a bit about all of those, the past, the present, and a look into the future. And we're going to be talking with Will about his own experience and a little bit more, because I'm excited to get in the conversation about hemp, because it is a buzzword. Will Allen believes that hemp is the salvation for farmers across America, and I can tell you this from my experience just in going to national conferences in the past couple of months, he is not alone. Having seen the rise and fall of Growing Power, a nonprofit that received national awards like the MacArthur Genius Award, Will has perspective, he has experience, and he has insight to share. So let's get started, and I can ask away. Welcome, Will Allen. It's great to have you back with us.
Well, it's great to be back with you, and I'm so happy about the success of your program, and just glad to be here to talk about both urban and rural farming, and to see how I can help move that forward, because we have a lot of issues that we need to overcome, from climate change to depressed pricing in the marketplace for everything from our dairy milk prices as well as vegetable prices and so forth. So it'd be good to give my perspective and understand this is my perspective with over 60 years of experience in farming, and coming from a family background of over 400 years of farming. So this is what I'd like to do today.
So really past, really past, really present, really future, with boots on the ground, like really knowing what you're doing. So can you just briefly share a little bit about your story when you say that, about how you are right where you are right now as a farmer? Just give us a brief overview, because there's lots of territory to cover.
Well, yeah, I grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., and on the border of Rockville and Bethesda, Maryland, to parents that were sharecroppers. So I kind of had my father, for some reason, and I've talked to you about this before, wanted me and my brothers to learn about where our food came from, and for practical reasons, because we were poor, to be able to grow our own food. So that's how I learned how to all the things that I'm teaching folks today, I learned from my parents that were passed down through generations. So where we are today, where I'm at today, after buying the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee in 1993, first 2 years I ran it as a for-profit organization, and for the next 23 years I ran it as a nonprofit, Growing Power, which reached the scales of farming over 350 acres of land, a lot of it in the city of Milwaukee. And in 2017, the board decided to disband the organization, which kind of left me hanging. So instead of, I was actually going through a few physical ailments at the time. Instead of just giving up, I pretty much jumped back on the horse into 2017, 2018, and went back to a for-profit operation, Will's Roadside Farm.
It's in your blood, Will. You're never getting away from it. It's like, you know, feel the force, Luke. It is your destiny. So there you have it. And it's been quite a journey for you, and I know that because you've been on the show before, and I heard you speak at a national conference. So there is so much going on in farming, and off air a little bit we talked about, I asked you what the weather was like, and that's never a question for me to pass the time, because talking about the weather is the topic of high interest around our country and around the world these days. And you said it's raining, we're behind on planting because it's been raining. Everywhere you look, there's aberrant weather conditions. So from your perspective, with so many things changing and changing quickly when it comes to agriculture, what does it look like when you look through your lens in terms of the current state of rural and urban agriculture? Very, very different. What are you seeing, Will Allen?
Well, from a rural perspective, I'm not so, optimistic because of climate change. We've seen what can happen in North Carolina last year with the hurricane. It pretty much destroyed the sweet potato crop in the state of North Carolina that grows, they're number one in sweet potato production. So that really spike prices in other areas of the country. We're seeing all this floods and so forth in Missouri and other states. So climate has a huge factor in rural agriculture. As far as what's happening in urban agriculture, because we don't have a lot of expertise in terms of ramping up production, it's always been my thing to train people, but a lot of people don't stay in urban agriculture beyond about 5 years. A lot of the younger people, because what happens is they start their organizations, the entrepreneurial farms on vacant lots and so forth. And after about 5 years, they look around. They've graduated from college. They look at their peers who went a different direction, and their peers are making six-figure salaries, and they're making $20,000 a year. And they're now 32 years old, and they want to start a family. And, so they say it's got to be a better life than trying to make it farming, because they go into this without any experience. And it's really important to have a lot of experience whenever you start a farming operation, either through a generational kind of perspective of learning from your parents or whatever, like I did, or working on a farm for a number of years. Because I think what we have to do is take farming more serious in terms of it is an art form. It is something that, just like any other profession, to call yourself a farmer, you have to go through, I think, this is my opinion, you have to go through a lot of ups and downs and training and learning before you can seriously call yourself a farmer. Because I see a lot of people farm for 1 year and they say, I'm a farmer.
And you're saying good luck with that.
Yeah. And a doctor can't say if you want to go to med school, you got to go to pre-med or whatever, and you go through all those years of medical school and so forth, or a lawyer or whatever, you got to do 3 years. So we have to be able to somehow train farmers, and we have to also show these young farmers that they can make a living out of farming. Now, there are some new things that have cropped up. I didn't know what hemp was 3 years ago. Because I've always been a vegetable farmer, and, where I come from, it's kind of a suburban kind of area and so forth. So I didn't know what hemp was about. And I was asked by a state senator to hold a meeting at our facility, and because she wanted to have inner city folks get involved in the hemp industry because they seem to be always left out. So I held a meeting, and a lot of folks came in to the meeting, and they had dollar signs in their eyes. And I said, oh, boy, we're in trouble. Because what they were thinking about was that this would be something that they could get into in terms of growing marijuana and not hemp. So they didn't do their due diligence and to find out what the possibilities would be for growing hemp, and they didn't have any agricultural experience, the people that showed up. And that seems to be what happens at larger conferences, too. You have very few farmers that actually can afford to go to those conferences that they have in Vegas and other places where, you know, you got to pay $1,000 to go to those conferences. It is just mostly investors and people who are selling products and services. So I said right away that it's something I should look into. So I spent 2017, like I always do when I start something new, doing my research and development, really learning as much as I could about how to grow hemp, what kind of soil it does it grow in aquaponics? Does it? How does it react? What is the difference between a male and a female plant? What are the different genetics, the seed genetics, to give you the highest milligrams of CBD and those sort of things? So I spent 2017, 2018 doing that indoors. And one of the things I wanted to do is grow it indoors because it's a phytoremediation plant, which means that it takes up whatever's in the soil. If there's arsenic in the soil, petrochemicals in the soil, lead, it'll put it into the plant. Therefore, it'll put it into the leaves and the flowers and buds and so forth. And if you're going to press that into oil, that's what you're going to get.
So,
and that was very...
I just like you to ask, press, pause for a minute, and I rarely do this, but I think before we jump into the hemp conversation, I would love for our listeners to go just a little bit deeper into the landscape of farmers and farming, and then go into the help into the hemp conversation, because I think there's pieces missing that will help listeners okay. understand why it's important. So if that's okay with you, I'd love to lay a little bit more groundwork before we jump into hemp and all of that. Is that, are you good with that?
That's fine. Just ask some questions.
Yeah, my question, like I have a couple of them. So in terms of organic farming, about which you know quite a bit, when you look at the anthropogenic carbon emissions that are exceeding the amount that can be taken up, or balanced out by natural sinks like soil, about half the carbon dioxide released from our burning fossil fuels still up to including today is not absorbed by vegetation and the oceans and remains in the atmosphere. So that's our big, huge, overarching problem for the impact of CO2 emissions and farming, especially organic farming, can be a solution to sequestering more carbon. So what are your thoughts on, in general, how we can develop urban agriculture to help get rid of carbon, or at least more aggressively sequester it?
Oh, that's a great question, because that's something I've been doing for years. For example, you know, like a lot of cities, 80% of their land mass is concrete and asphalt. I've been growing on concrete and asphalt, and to be able to do that, what I do is I put about 10 inches of wood chip down on top of the asphalt, and then I put 24 inches of compost that, you know, because I compost on a pretty large scale, so I grow, I call it growing soil. And if you're able to do that, you can start, you turn these, this asphalt and concrete into, back into an area that can sequester CO2, carbon. So that's something that I think we can do inside our cities and wherever possible, because there's so much vacant asphalt and concrete in old buildings. Like you take cities like Pittsburgh and Chicago and Milwaukee and Flint, Michigan and Detroit. There's so much. As I go through those cities, that's what I look for. I say, where can I put a farm? And, you know, so you can capture that carbon in the soil just like it would be natural grass or whatever, you know, so in a rural area. So I think that can be part of this green revolution if we can get cities to get on top of this. One of the biggest problems we have with urban agriculture is that these cities, city fathers, and need to break off some funding for urban agriculture. That hasn't happened in a big way. Similar to what happened in Cuba when the Russians left and the government got behind organic agriculture in Cuba, and now look what it did to change the dynamics of people's lives in Cuba in terms of they're having a longer life expectancy than we do in the U.S. because they changed their diet, because they're eating a lot healthier than they were when the Russians were feeding them, bringing in food from outside.
So that's really important, though. If you hone in on that, because to me, there are so many positives to any block that's vacant, any land that's vacant. Putting a rooftop garden on is not easy, but it goes back to what you said. These are things that are so doable. It would help with heat islands. It would help with sequestering carbon. It would help provide healthy food for people in cities. There's just no downside. But to your point, you just don't jump into it. And I've learned so much, even with an interview I had just a couple of weeks ago with someone from the National Wildlife Federation about living in the desert and planting wildlife flowers as opposed to tulips. I don't really need tulips in Tucson, Arizona. But for someone like you, you don't just go set up a farm. There's lots of research. So much goes into it, including what are the best crops for this area? And to me, what are affordable crops? You know, because that's another the great divide where if you want to get USDA certified organic food at Whole Foods, you better bring your pocketbook because it can be pricey. There are much more alternative, affordable options at places like Sprouts and farmers markets. But to your point, people should be looking through the lens of where can we create more green spaces, because everybody wins. There's no downside, but you have to make it so that people can have a livable wage.
Absolutely, and that's what it's all about. And it's about folks getting trained, job creation is part of that. But like I said, one of the most important things that we must make happen is that we have to get in these cities to give money, break off some money, take the budget from something else and put it, because it's so important, because there's so many sick people, especially people of color in our cities that are suffering with diabetes, heart disease, and so forth, eating really bad food when it's totally unnecessary. And to be able to compost, 40% of the food that we cook never gets eaten. So there's lots of material to compost. There's a lot of nitrogen. There's lots of carbon in terms of wood chip. We have these storms that take down trees, and we have all of this carbonish material to be able to grow soil. So that's what we've been doing. I've been doing this all my life, but we started this at Growing Power in a really large-scale models of thousands of yards of compost to be able to do the growing that we've been able to do inside the city. So I really want to connect with those folks that are talking about the Green Revolution. And what are some of the proactive things that we can do because we don't really have a choice, because it's going to be devastating to see what's going to happen in terms of our cities and really all over the country, all over the world, in terms of all of these floods and so forth. Because I can actually capture, if I did an acre garden inside a city, I can capture the water of a 3 or 4 inch rain. It wouldn't leave that area.
It's so connected. Yes. And then that helps with storm water management, because you're not getting polluted water. You're capturing it and being able to do it. You know, I just went down the rabbit hole when I was prepping for this show and thinking of all of the benefits of urban agriculture. And like you said, the health benefits. And there are some exciting things in that space. I watched a special on, it might have been Vice News or 60 Minutes. They're all, they all jumble up together for me, but it was a wonderful special about a world-renowned chef, and I believe he was from Oslo, who came to, I think it was New Bedford, maybe, Connecticut, and he decided to change his life. And his restaurant It took a year to get a reservation. The average bill for two people was $1,000. And he just said, my life felt empty. So he came back and he is, oh my gosh, Will, you would love it. He is putting healthy food along with this visionary school superintendent in all of the schools and their next market. And they already have a project in place is New York. They're going to put it in all the schools in New York where kids in schools are actually going to get healthy and fresh food. What a concept.
Well, I was just with Alice Waters and Ron Finley here in Milwaukee 3 weeks ago. And Alice, who I've known for a long time, she's really promoting, and I agree with her 100%. And I'm trying to help her in terms of being able to take out the middleman.
Yes.
And deliver food. This is her big deal right now, to deliver food from the farm directly to the schools. So that is the most important thing we can do at this time for the next generation. Because what we try to do a lot of times at schools is we try to have a little school garden, and we think we're doing, which is a great, it's a good thing if you can do that, but not all schools can do that in our cities. But it's important for those kids to eat food directly from the farm, and that helps keep the farmer in business because the farmer can start getting a price for their goods that they should be getting, and not 10% of the dollar, not 10 cents on the dollar that most farmers make. So we need to cut out that middle, those wholesalers that jack the prices up. The farmers have to sell to them to get it into the schools. But I did it. We did it with 30,000 pounds of carrots. I delivered directly to the Chicago public school system about 3 years ago for a one-day consumption for their 500,000 students that they have in CPS in Chicago.
I mean, those are numbers. It can be done. I mean, those are numbers if you have urban agriculture. And even here in Tucson, we have a very successful food co-op. And they're doing creative things like lending to small farms with a very low interest loan so that they can develop more acres, so that they can have more supply, so that there's consistent supply at the food co-op for certain things. And I know kale is one of them. And it creates community. So those it's Sleeping Frog Farm. They stay in our community. It's good for our atmosphere. It's good for our land. And it's a good business model. I mean, there's a whole community of them, families. It's almost like a commune out there. But the food co-op in this public-private partnership helped them to do it. Let's go a little bit deeper into the whole organic farming conversation, because it happens to be something that I know quite a bit about, because a good friend of mine, he and his wife bought land in Oregon. And they have means. He had a very successful used bookstore operation here, and he still has like 7 used books, and it's gone into recycled musical instruments and on and on. So he's got money, and he would say that. He talked to us. We just had dinner with him. He came to Tucson, and he was talking about, I said, so Bob, where are you with your certification for USDA certified organic? And I know the steps, and you can walk us through it. You don't just have an organic farm. It takes time, and time means it takes money. So for the organic certification, can you tell a little bit about what that takes? Because not everybody knows. You don't just open up and say, oh, these are organic and I'm going to get them USDA certified next week.
You're right. Yeah, it takes time. Right now I'm getting another farm certified through MOSA. We had to pay $700 up front just to get the application started. And there's a gazillion questions that you have to answer about past, what has been grown on that land in the past, and what you're going to grow, and the different crops. You have to name every crop that you're going to grow, the amounts that you're going to grow. There's a lot of paperwork. It's not just cut and dry. It takes, even if they are rushing it through for you, it takes at least, we've been working on this for over 6 months already to get this farm certified.
So, and for Bob, it's taken 3 years because they had a non-organic farm for their pear trees and their cherry trees. So they have to actually make sure the soil does not have any insecticides, pesticides, and herbicides. So it's there's a whole process which adds more time and more money if you have to do that. So it's not just easy, is my point. So I want to ask you this, not to put you on the spot, but do you think that that is critical, that farms that are going in that direction are USDA certified, or and that's the gold standard? Or are there other certifications that are could be trusted?
No, I think it. I think people need to get USDA certified by a certifying agency like MOSA here in Wisconsin, and because it's important. Like I mentioned before, a lot of these plants, food that we eat, you know, we want to make sure that we're not growing it in toxic soil or Roundup. Soil that was had Roundup on it the year before. It takes at least 2 years to clean up the soil on a farm before you can get certified. So it's really important that we have that kind of certification and those checks, because we want to eat healthy food. And like I said, if you're going to do a diversified farm where you have hemp growing and you have your vegetables growing and you're pairing hemp that is going to be CBD oil for folks, you want to be able to pair that with healthy organic greens and tomatoes and beets and things like that. You know, I think it's going to be, like I said before, and I don't want to get back on the hemp kick right now, but
I think it's a perfect segue, but you're right about this whole track, because to me, and I didn't know what you'd answer to that question, and I'm glad you did that, because there has to be some things that we can trust, and so far in my world, you really can trust the USDA certified. There are standards. I want to be able to go to a store in Taos, New Mexico, and in Los Angeles, California, and New York City, and know that the same standard applied. And if you start diluting that, then I think it's a real slippery slope, because what's compromised then is my health. And, you know, if you interview people, like I interviewed a mom that started Moms Across America, three of her children were deathly ill. One of them had four early indicators for autism, and all three of them had severe allergies. And Will, I know that you know this is true. She changed their diet. She did a deep dive into research for allergies. They were suffering horribly, and she changed their diet. And she said that was quite a long time ago, 3.5 years, and none of them have been to the doctor. I mean, talk about, and the autism indicators, they're gone. And I don't think people understand how important it is for our health, for how long we live, that just put the money into eating healthy and it saves you money. That's my thing. It's like, no, this is not expensive. Well, yeah. This is a lifesaver. It won't make you miss work. You won't be sick. You'll live a longer, healthier life. So yes, let's keep USDA certified as the gold standard. So let's talk about hemp, because to me, it's blowing my mind, Will. It's like a wildfire. Some guy I met at a meeting the other day, he wants to meet with me about, are you ready for this? Hemp air filters for air conditioners. And he was amazing what he told me. And I believe him, and I know a lot about the hemp industry, enough to be dangerous. But it's so confusing. It's such a buzzword. I think there's probably going to be, as with every growth, charlatans out there. So what do you want to tell us about your excitement around hemp?
Okay. This is what's happening right now. There's a lot of research, medical schools. I've seen this thing in the last 3 years just go crazy. There's so many people using CBD oils. Many of them are not very good or effective, because there's very little regulatory things going on with hemp, especially in Wisconsin. We just started it. So So there's no regulatory folks. I just heard on WBBM in Chicago. I listen to that station religiously every day. And somebody from the state ag department was on. Illinois has just been given the green light.
So to farmers speak. The green light. I love it.
To start growing hemp. And they were telling people $100 for a license, industrial hemp license. And they were practically begging people to sign up because the season starts very quickly. When I say the season starts, it means that you can start planting as soon as you get out of the danger of frost because the plant is very susceptible to the cold. It will die very quickly at about 37 degrees. At 37 degrees with some wind, it wouldn't survive outside. So they're trying to rush this thing through so they can get as many growers as possible in Illinois. Now, Illinois already has medical marijuana with 16 growers in the state of Illinois, which is not very many, but that's where they're at. But what I wanted to do is to make sure that people understood that you can't grow this in just any soil because it's a phytoremediation plant. It has to be grown in clean soil. And that's one of the reasons that I grow it in my own soil inside hoop houses and greenhouses. That's the only way I grow it. Because if you just go outside and you haven't had your soil tested and you plant it and you sell it to somebody, it's going to make it into oil. You have no idea what you're ingesting. Because you ingest it, you can use it topically, the oils or the lotions topically, or you can use the oil sublingually under your tongue. You put it under your tongue, and it enters your body. There's a number of different ways. Gummies, they make gummies out of it now, and a whole, they cook with hemp powders and oils and so forth. So there's a number of ways to ingest it, but it must be a clean product. And the only way to make sure it's a clean product, you have to make sure it's USDA organically certified. To date, I've only found three companies that have USDA organically certified oil. And one of them is my company that I started in November. So that's where it's at. Now, the other piece of what I'm working on in the city, there are so many vacant buildings. So I teach at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. I teach a course there in the history of urban agriculture, and my students have to do a project. So I have three students that are working on a design that I gave them to design a system to be able to grow it inside, say, a 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 building with grow lights and aquaponics. Because one of the discoveries that I made was that it grows twice as fast in aquaponics than any other way. So that's what I'm working on now. And I've been approached by the city of Milwaukee and older people and other people around the country. Because nobody is growing it in aquaponics. They're growing
that's
it in
hydroponics. That's revolutionary. I mean, it is. That's really huge. So I'd love to go there a little bit with you, if that's okay. I mean, that's really big news as far as I'm concerned. And I'll tell you why. Because one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, first of all, do you have to be certifiable, stark, raving mad to even want to go into farming, given the aberrant weather conditions we have? But we know that would be a rhetorical question, because farmers are passionate. And you're right, there's the people that think it looks easy and I'm just going to live off the land and kumbaya. And the last thing in the world I ever want to be is a farmer, because I know how hard it is. I could never. Your work is never done. But for hemp, okay, when you say it has to be grown indoors, I see a world where more and more and more growing is going to have to happen indoors because you have floods that wipe out three states of agriculture.
Absolutely.
You have tornadoes, you have hurricanes, you have microbursts, you have freezing in the summer. It snows up until May in some places now. Like you said, it's raining where you are. So in terms of when I said to you about past, present, and future, you're already operating in the future for what has to happen. Agreed?
Yes. I really, there are some other pieces to this I have to tell you about.
Do tell.
Because imagine, you have to use your imagination a little bit here. If you can,
I'm good at that.
100,000 square foot building, and you have a fish run, and next to the fish run, you have 10 beds growing hemp, or it could be a mixture of other vegetables, because other vegetables grow very well next to. It's a great companion crop, by the way, I found out. So you don't have to have a building that's just full of hemp, but you could be growing lettuces, you could be growing tomatoes, you could be growing any crop inside these buildings for the very reasons that you said, because of climate change and you can't grow outside. Now, most of the hemp production in this country is going to be grown outside because most farmers don't have the infrastructure to be able to grow it inside. But inside our cities, to get folks in the cities to create jobs and so forth, which was this senator's aim was to get the folks that live inside cities involved in growing would be inside. And it's something that I think in the future is going to happen. But you have to have customers.
Right, that's kind of essential.
Yeah, the question is who can be your customers? So if you look outside of the circle, I'm going to say the circle because I played basketball, you know, former basketball player.
Good that you explained that. Okay.
Yeah, I have to explain that all the time. You really want to look at customers. And what are the main customers of the future? And unfortunately, we have this condition in the U.S. Depression is like our number one ailment right now, right?
Yep.
Number one, I don't care what anybody says. They can look at cancer. They can look at all kinds of things.
Look at suicide rates.
Yeah, the depression. So one of my biggest customer is a psychiatric clinic. Actually, it's 5 psychiatric clinics that I deliver my oil to. And the reason that they're so excited about it, the psychiatrist, one of the leading psychiatrists in the Milwaukee area, he said it gives him another tool in his toolbox to treat people. Because what that oil does, it really helps with depression. It helps with people that have sleep disorders. It helps with so many different things. There are also over 100 different products that you can derive out of hemp. But one of the main things, like I said, is the oil to help people with depression. So they're very excited about it. It's still experimental in terms of how they're using it and how they're... Because a lot of the psychiatric medications from the old days have changed. They can't even use them anymore. So they're limited in terms of how they treat people. And this leaves no adverse effects on folks when they use... there's no side effects like these other... medications. As a matter of fact, he says there are medications that actually shrink people's brains, that the medications are so strong. So I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know a lot about the psychiatric world, but it's really given me a great customer. It really matches what I want to do to use growing hemp as a wellness tool along with the good food that I grow. So it makes me feel good when I get wonderful testimonies back from folks that it really helps.
And as a product, what I think is really important to understand is that from what I have read in my research, it's different from the marijuana plant, okay? It can be used for human food. I know that there's an application for pet food, healthy, and pet vetting. It's such a durable plant. I know it can be put, as you said, in body oils and lotions, clothing, plastic, paper. I mean, it is the application for it. But I do want to ask you this. So is it important for something like hemp? I, of course, know what I think, and I hope it's what you think, for it to be, when you say it has to be grown clean, to have it be USDA certified, because it's not mostly for consumption, but organic farming helps everything. Our rivers, our streams, all of the wildlife, our air, CO2 emissions. So it's another one that it should be organic. Yes?
Yes, I would not ingest it if it wasn't organically certified. I tell people that at the workshops that we have, because what we've done here in Milwaukee is we have workshops about once a month to inform the consumer of what's out there, because there's so many. If you go into a vape shop or any of these little shops that sell the product, they don't give folks any information. They just want to sell products. You can buy stuff for $40 a bottle, $20 a bottle, a low milligram CBD. It's very little information. It has a lot of additives to it. Our product has zero additives. It is cold-pressed. It's full spectrum, which means that we use the leaves, the stems, and the flowers to press it at low heat into a final product that's pure hemp. It has to be USDA certified if you want to make sure that you're ingesting something that's healthy. Unless you absolutely know your farmer, where you live next door and you know your farmer is using organic methods, but not certified.
Right. Very, very, very good point. Very good point. Because people go to the farmer's market and they think, oh, I'm at the farmer's market, this is healthy. Well, you can't assume that at all. You have to ask your farmer, do you use pesticides, insecticides, herbicides? How do you control pests? You have to find a way. And the thing about a farmer's market, we go to the same one, so you can vet your farmers pretty quickly, and they're honest. I mean, I buy my heirloom tomatoes from a man that it's not all certified organic, and they're the best heirloom tomatoes I ever had. So we all have our guilty pleasures. Well, let's talk a little bit. Go ahead.
I would say know your farm. You know, it's the old saying, know your food or whatever.
Right. So do you see hemp being grown in every region in the country, or is it going to be limited to some areas? Where is it most conducive to grow hemp?
Well, you can grow hemp in almost every, you can, in every area, even Arizona, where it's, you know, hot. It doesn't require a lot of water, which is great. It can withstand heat, because my greenhouses sometimes get over 100 degrees and it doesn't affect the plant. So I've done a lot of my own R&D so I can inform people that you can grow it in different areas of the country. You can grow it inside and get multiple crops inside greenhouses or buildings in a year. In cold climates like Minnesota, Wisconsin, and most of the northern tier, you only get one crop outside. It doesn't like a lot of water. It has to be grown in well-drained soil. But for some reason, in pots like I grow it in aquaponics, it seems the water doesn't seem to affect the plant at all. As a matter of fact, one of the products that we're going to get tested, because we just have a new testing lab that opened up at one of our universities, University of Wisconsin Parkside in Kenosha County, on the border of Kenosha and Racine County. They have a testing lab, and the roots, tremendous root system. The white roots may have some CBD in the roots, but they have omega-3s, and they have a lot of other nutritious things in the roots of the plants. So we're going to get that tested, and that's something that they don't have on the market yet. So, you know, I like to do things that nobody else is doing. That's what excites me, is at my age of 70 years old, I still get excited about trying something new, discovering something new. So I'm really at this stage of trying to pass on to the next generation things that I can discover sort of benefit mankind.
And you're what we call in our world a disruptor for good, and you're leading the charge. I mean, let's kind of wrap this up with my final question about, I've loved everything we've talked about, but when you look through the lens of climate change and its impact on our food supply in general, is this not just hemp, but how do we change things so that we really can feed America? You and I know, if you believe the science, if you look at the news, if you believe the pictures they show of entire states being flooded beyond anybody's worst nightmare, Nebraska, oh my gosh, I mean, we're getting things, blights are wiping things out. So things will, there will be crops that are cross prohibitive. And it's hitting America already. So when you look through that lens, what do you see in terms of how we can start thinking about preparing to feed America, to keep feeding? I mean, we're doing it, but other countries, it's worse in some other countries with droughts and blights and olive trees being wiped out in Italy. I mean, the story goes on. So you've been this, it's in your blood. It was in your, you know, fourth generation. What do we do, Will? What are some of the answers? Give us some hope here.
Okay, let's take what's happening in Wisconsin, because I know that best. Last year, we lost 780 farmers in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, my gosh.
Mostly dairy, small dairy farmers, because Wisconsin was built on our dairy industry, still number one in cheese. We don't have the biggest dairy farms anymore, but we... many of the small dairy guy who had 100 cow operations, 150 cow operations, it's hard for them to make money because of the depressed milk prices that are out there. So knowing that, that's why I made that statement where I said that hemp could be, this new crop could be the savior of many of these farms, because let's say you have a small dairy farm and all of a sudden this crop shows up that you can start growing as another crop on your farm that can bring you some income, because you've been dairying all your life. You're generationally, you've been dairying and you don't want to get out of the business, but you're able to make a living that way from a rural perspective. What we need to do, because we've lost so many farmers, is we need to grow some new farmers. Now that's going to be a big challenge. We have to train some young people, but we have to show them an economic model that they can make money farming.
Yes.
Because farming is fun, and we need to make it fun by being able to grow inside, because I don't think a young person wants to be out in October like I've been doing for years and digging carrots when it's snowing and raining at the same time, and it's in October, early October. Young people don't want to do that kind of farming. But if they can do aquaponics and grow hemp and other crops and aquaponics or hydroponics or aeroponics or whatever, that's something that I think a lot of young people can gravitate to if we can show them an economic model that they can make a decent living, a living that their peers are making in other industries. I think that, to me, is the future, and that's what I want to do, is pass on the learning that I have in terms of those young people, and we're going to start having workshops on how to grow hemp and how to grow other vegetables. Again, I haven't done it for the last year because of the transition back to my for-profit, but we've trained thousands of people over the years, and we need to get back to that.
And you think about the people, and when I go on and on and on, I mean, you and I could go on a 20-minute rant right this minute about when we let people out of prison. We're not going to go down there too deep because I can't talk about it right now without crying because of a show I watched last night with Van Jones. But when you let people out of prison that could have been in there and wrongly convicted, imagine that, or they serve their time, they are truly ready to come back into society, we say, okay, good luck, don't recidivate, here's your $14. There's uses for, there's so many creative things in the farming industry that could be done to answer that would help everybody. Veterans, they have been to the hinges of hell. Some of them have been in hell and back. And there are some movements where we could put veterans to work in such a healthy way. So if we would just focus on that a little bit, I think what I'm going to do here is like announce I'm running for president. Why not? Everybody else is. Well, you could be my vice president. But if you think about it, this is such a win-win-win-win. It's not like the green trifecta. It's the green multifecta because we are all going to need to eat. The healthier the food supplies are, we all win. The planet wins. The heat islands win. The food deserts win. And if we just rechanneled, you know this, if we rechanneled 1% of what we spend on what we give to private prisons that are, oh, by the way, falling apart, locks aren't working, prison guards' lives are at risk, and in some cases, it's just a horrible picture. This is an answer that gives hope and inspiration, and everybody wins. I mean, I know I sound like I'm on a soapbox, but hopefully I'm singing your song.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't know if I talked about this the last time I was on, but we had a program about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, where we had a training program of 150 former folks that have been in prison with felony records that nobody would hire. And we put them to work building hoop houses. And the reason I have so many hoop houses is because they built them. Instead of paying them minimum wage or sub-minimum wage, one of the things that I did was I started them at $12 an hour, untrained, because I wanted to make sure that they would stick around if they had a decent wage. Now, $12 an hour is not a living wage, even in Wisconsin, and surely not in Arizona or California.
It's just not a living wage. Let's just say that. It's not a living wage, period. End of story.
But most of the programs that train ex-prisoners are sub-minimal wage or minimum wage, not $12 an hour. So it was challenging. It was very challenging because one of the things that happened, and I'll tell you, is that as soon as they got their first paycheck, because of the computers today can pick up on child support that wasn't paid, a lot of them had their checks garnished, not their entire check, but a percentage of their check, which caused me, as the trainer and operator of the program, a lot of issues because they would run in and say, why am I not getting, you know, which I had no control
right,
of that.
Right,
so there
right.
are some issues. That's why I said the cities have to chime in and help. You can't do this all by yourself. Even though it's a great idea, but you have to have partners in being able to do this. It won't work unless you have these joint ventures or partnerships with folks from the city or nonprofits kicking in to be able to train these folks.
How about the federal government with all of the federal prisons and the billions, not millions, billions of dollars that they have spent putting in the pockets of private prison owners? You know,
yeah,
that it's there, and there's people on the left and on the right and in the middle saying this is just wrong.
Right.
Some of the top people in the Senate are shareholders in some of those private prisoners. And I'm not trying to be divisive. I'm really not. I'm saying if you take a look at this situation and you use your rational brain and you let facts get in the way, which we're all capable of doing, and most of us want to do the right thing, let's look at how we can make more farmers make a livable wage, because we all win. And the life you save may be your own. That's how I feel. It's like we've got to see big shifts in this arena because our food supplies are dramatically at risk every day we go forward with this aberrant weather, just that alone. So I kind of liked that soapbox there for a minute. I think I should do a podcast called Mrs. Green Rants because it's like I better be careful not getting to the sound of my own voice.
You're right on. And I mean, the important thing is for us to continue to have farmers. We have to make sure those farmers pay a fair wage.
I love what you said, know your farmer and grow your farmers. We need to grow our farmers. I like that.
And that's something that Alice Waters, Ron Finley, and I talk about all the time, is that we have to make sure that farmers are paid a proper wage.
Yes.
For the work that they do. Because without them, that saying, no farmers, no food, that's what it's going to... I mean, we'll be able to get some food, but do you want to eat that food? Is it going to make you healthy? Is it going to keep you healthy? Some of that stuff that's out there that we call food that we know is not really food.
Like there's not one bit of nutrition in it. So you're right. And it's really great. I just made a note to get Alice Waters on the show, especially with new initiatives. I mean, that's why Dr. Goodall is going to come back on the show, because she has lots to say for the next iteration and a new book. And it's Alice Waters, I think, would do great, especially since our listenership has increased so much. So we're going to wrap up. Do you have a final word?
Alice on your show. I mean, it would be...
I think that would be great. And I'll tell Kelly if we have any problem with getting connections with her, which I don't think we will. Will Allen is our guy. Okay.
Yeah, just have him call me and I'll hook you up with Alice. She's a very good friend.
Okay, so stay with me while I say some really good words to wrap this up. And as I say, my regular listeners know, I love having the last word. So my thoughts on everything we talked about, combined with knowing quite a bit about food security and food deserts, are many. But the most important one I would like for you to think about is how important our farmers are and how important the growth of organic farms is. Organic farms contribute to many good things in the overall impact of climate change picture that articulating their massive impact would be challenging at best. Organic is better for our health, for the health of our wildlife, and for the health of our rivers and lakes and streams and oceans, and without question, better for the health of our planet. I invite you all to do your own research just about the benefits of buying organic food for your health and that of your family. I believe you will then officially know better if you don't already, and to know better, as we all know, is to do better. And we all need to do better to support a healthy, sustainable, and socially just planet. Let's celebrate knowing better. And more importantly, let's celebrate doing better, because together we can make a bigger difference. Thanks for being a part of my world. And Will Allen, thanks for showing up in mine once again. Thanks for all you're doing, and let's stay in touch.
Yes. Is it possible I could give you my website here?
All of that will be on the show notes, because a lot of people are listening on the fly. So when they click on to our page for your podcast, Kelly will have all that with a direct link, and you can absolutely shout it out right now if you want to. Yes, you may.
Okay. It's Will Allen's BeyondOrganic.com.
And it's A-L-L-E-N. That's what you have to make sure you know. A-L-L-E-N. Will Allen's with an S, BeyondOrganic.com.
BeyondOrganic.com.
Yes, we'll do that. And then everybody, I say this all the time, two great shows coming up. Our Down to Earth Spotlight on the Southwest is a man named Adam Mintner, who's an author. He works for Bloomberg, just incredible human being. And Judy Roman Bukasas, who is the Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona. And he wrote a book and he's going to talk about it in this podcast, Secondhand, An Unexpected Adventure into the World of Thrift Stores. He's fascinating. The podcast, we've already recorded it. It's great. That'll be out on June 6th. And on June 11th, another one. And Will, just right up your alley, just on a different space, David Mizujewski, he's a naturalist and author. He's has his own TV show. He's had a radio show. He goes around speaking for the National Wildlife Federation. And his book, The Butterfly Effect, that's not the name of his book, but I bought his book. And we're going to be talking about The Butterfly Effect, Creating Garden Magic. And it's more about creating wildflowers, like in the Southwest, what's indigenous to this area. Great show. So, Will, thank you. I'm glad we made it work. And good luck. And I'm sure our paths will cross at some time again.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to meeting you in person. And
same here.
Just keep shouting out about climate change, about organic food. And
yeah, and about hemp. I'm on the hemp bandwagon. Okay, thank you, my friend. This was great.
Thank you.